for the opportunity here. My main goal is really to get you to think about gravity as part of our other interactions. There's a tendency in the way we teach these courses to separate them greatly. But in fact, gravity behaves and is constructed much like the rest of our other interactions, and behaves at low energies in the same way. So I know I'm supposed to do it as a effective field theory, but
We have a podium here. Does it think it's going to make a difference, or
I don't know what's the podium like. And so if you take gravity and you put it together with the rest of the standard model, you get the law, our core theory. The core theory is a phrase that Wilczek proposed just to say that this is how we think of the world. And it's basically what's written here. We have gauge fields, fermions, the Higgs, and we have, This is getting fancy. We also have gravity, and it fits in together. The one feature that's unusual here is when I write this path integral, there's a cutoff there. We know all of these theories work at low energies, and we don't know what happens to any of them as we get to high energies. So we've come to think of all of our theories as effective field theories, and gravity is no different. So this is the overall my topic, to redo gravity much like we do our other theories. And the other lesson is that quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, loves general relativity in much the same way that it does all the other interactions at ordinary energies. All right, actually, my writing gets worse too bad that way. I'm gonna do it here. Okay, so. We will get this technology. The podium, I think, will not work.
If you can reconnect it.
No. Here we go. All right. So the
other way to go is a chair surgery.
Yeah, that's the other option, is I can just sit. But it looks a little funny with me sitting down here. Yeah, I do know that one of the advantages of that is it takes me out of my lecturer voice, where I stand up here and lecture, and gets me to conversational voice where I talk like friends. So along the way, we do effective field theory. In fact, today, much of today is going to be effective field theory presented at a slightly different way than you normally see it. I'm going to focus on effective field theories that are close to that of general relativity, because then when I do general relativity, you'll see all the same ingredients. Now, if you've seen effective field theories, I like to call it effective field theories 1.0. And that is used in common use these days in physics beyond the standard model. And I know that Matthew presented a lot of that. So if you have operators that go like psi bar psi, then if you have operators that give you some new physics, you can parameterize them by local operators. That's truly effective field theory, but it's a simple version of it. Really, the lesson is that effective field theory is a full quantum theory. It's no lesser than renormalizable quantum field theory as far as making predictions at low energies. It has a feature that it reveals its weakness at very high energies. But nevertheless, it's a good normal quantum field theory at regular energy scales. And so today I end up spending a good deal of time talking about how to make it a full effective field theory. And then along the way, we do some techniques that don't always make it into usual field theory courses. I want to also do the background field method. Which is a useful technique for doing quantum field theory, especially in the connection to effective field theories. And now, I realize that many of you are experimenters, and this seems like a bit of a theoretical topic, but please indulge me, and we'll try to do it without too much formalism and try to get you to think about that.
Also true, not as many as I thought.
Oh, really? Is that true? Well, then we can adapt. So a little bit of bookkeeping as we go. By using this, I'm going to try to post my notes, assuming that this continues to work okay. I have a web page that I will post them on, and maybe we can post it here, but it already is seeded a little bit with stuff, so I'm going to... There are some exercises up there already, if you're interested in doing exercises. There are some background articles. There's lecture notes. There's an appendix from the Dynamics of the Standard Model, which is a book that I was co-author of that is useful for some of the formalism that I intend to do. And I'll update this as we go. So let's actually start talking about effective field theory in general. The effective field theory, I like to start with the following question. Why does ordinary quantum mechanics work? So okay, now of course this sounds like a silly question. We know that it works. But in fact, there's a puzzle associated with the calculations there that most people don't answer correctly when I ask. So let's imagine I'm doing perturbation theory, and we're instructed in perturbation theory to sum over intermediate states. We have initial states, interactions, intermediate states. Interaction, final states. So we're doing perturbation theory, and we have energy denominators. Now you know that that's just a precursor to doing loops in quantum field theory, but even here, we're instructed to do all intermediate states. Yet physics is an experimental science, and we don't yet know all intermediate states. So when we say all, it actually includes things that are beyond the reach of the LHC. And so how are we supposed to do that? When I ask this question in my quantum mechanics class, people say, well, there's an energy denominator there. And that's wrong, because in fact, this sum gets converted into, in the end, integral D3P when you do continuum states. So in fact, it grows. At high energies, the kinematics favors the high states. If you say, well, then maybe there are no interactions connecting low-lying states to high-energy states, that's also wrong. You, in fact, if you look at it carefully enough, see that there's always ways that you can get to high-energy states. So how can you get... do any calculation. So for, you know, in field theory, the example is we do this, and that this is the photon, and this is some charged particle that carries 1,000 TeV of energy. It's there in the loop. It connects up to what we see. So how can we make any of the calculations work? Well, the answer actually comes down to the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle tells us that you know, we have delta x, delta p is order one, that high energy stuff becomes local. So the locality of high energy is the key here. And when we write out a local Lagrangian Hamiltonian, which is our starting point, the Lagrangian has local terms in it. Those local terms have parameters. We measure those parameters, and the high energy stuff goes here. So the uncertainty principle tells us that we have local effects from the high energy stuff. And so let's do an example. I have an example set up here. So let's do the heavy particle in loops. So we do a photon exchange, we do a loop, we do two loops, et cetera. And as you know, you end up with then this becomes if this is the electric charge, we have a charge, which is here a bare charge, 1/q², and then 1 minus, it's a vacuum polarization function, that's a function of q². Okay. And so the effects of this get summed up into that vacuum polarization, and I've reproduced the form of the vacuum polarization here. Those of you that are taking notes by hand should look at the bottom line here, and the things that you should watch for are there's a log of m² and the 1/m² pieces. Those are going to be the parts of my story. Now you, of course, also see the divergences there. And we know that you absorb the divergences into a redefined coupling. So the typical thing you could do is you could absorb that those first few terms into MS bar renormalization. And so this then...
Is Q imaginary?
No, Q is real, but it can be positive or negative.
So you've got ln of negative q² over mu². So one of those has to be complex.
So the q² can be positive or negative. When q² is negative, which is space-like stuff, I'm sorry, who's speaking? Oh, there you are. Okay. When q² is negative, then the log is the usual feature.
Oh, it's the four vector for some reason.
It's the four vector. Yeah, that's right. It's the four vector. When q² is positive, that log picks up, there's a minus I pi that comes from that log minus sign there that gives you the imaginary part, which is the real on-shell production of particles in time-like q², okay? Okay, so if I just do MS bar renormalization, we absorb the first set of factors there, and then the propagator turns into 1/q² E MS bar squared. But then the residual stuff besides the epsilon 4 pi and gamma is still there. I get 1 plus E² / 12π² log m² / μ² plus dot dot dot. Okay, so at this stage, I've done renormalization, but I still have this feature that it's sensitive to the mass of the heavy particle in there. Okay. Now this would throw off your calculations. I've renormalized, I'm going to calculate, but I need to know how many heavy particles there are. But in fact, I've misstated one step here. I haven't actually completed the process. I haven't gone out and actually measured this charge. At this stage, I have to measure the charge, and at some stage, some Q squared, I can do that. You know, the typical one for QED is that Q squared equals to zero. And so if I measure this at Q squared equals to zero, this factor right here, I have written there, goes into that measurement. And so the mass disappears into the measurement. And so then, so I basically take 1 over Q squared, bar squared, 1 minus, it's basically pi of 0, and that goes into E physical squared over Q squared near Q squared equals to 0. Okay. And then the residual effect, so this then takes care of that mass. The mass is gone, and I have a residual effect, which is just the 1 over the Q squared over M squared piece. And the residual effect then is if I just expand it out, I get E physical squared over Q squared, plus now I've expanded it out, E physical squared Q squared times the expansion of this is another E squared over 12 pi squared Q squared. The Q squareds cancel. And I get just a if I Fourier transform this, I get the 1 over R plus a delta function of X, which is the well-known low energy effect that's part of the Lamb shift. So but I forgot the important part here. I've got the Q squared over M squared. The basic feature here is that the dominant piece, the log m squared, disappears into the renormalization measurement, and the residual piece is left over as a 1 over m squared effect. It's a local effect in position space, which gives us, ties into our locality argument. So this, what I just illustrated there, is part of what's called the Apoquist-Carazone theorem. The effects of a heavy mass particle appear either as renormalization of a coupling constant or as a power suppressed correction. And so this is the locality part that we have. The coupling constant is a local piece. This power suppressed part is local. So we've got the first principle here is locality. Okay, I do have to put a little caveat here. This theorem is not true if when taking the limit, you violate an intrinsic symmetry of the theory. So the classic example here is if I take M topped large and M B finite, in SU2, that breaks the SU2 symmetry terribly. And then you end up with log mt squared or power law mt squared effect in the standard model in such a limit. So that's the feature. Okay. The second organizing principle is the energy expansion. Okay, we've seen that there are power suppressed terms that come out. These can have increasing powers. We organize in powers of the low energy scale over the heavy scale. Okay. And then express the results in such an expansion. This is the feature that you know. This is the stuff that you've been taught regularly at this stage. An example here is what I just did, is if I did QED this way, the effect of Lagrangians that come out for QED is the one that I just calculated is alpha over 6d pi m squared. It'd be written as f mu nu box f mu nu. So the box was the q squared that we saw in the actual calculation. So q squared over m squared, and the alpha over 60 pi is just to match up with the coefficient. There would be corrections that go like f box squared over m to the fourth, f plus higher order one. So there's the energy expansion. And then there can also be higher order operators, which let me just write as 1 over m squared f squared. So these are the Euler-Heisenberg-Lagrangian, and I could write that out in great detail, but let's not.
And m to the eighth there, right?
And I'm sorry?
1 over m to the eighth?
M to the eighth, yes. That's m to the fourth. M to the fourth.
Fourth.
All right. But now the third principle is the one that I want to focus a little bit more on. And this is the quantum field theory aspects. Let me call it matching or measuring. Okay, so what are we doing here? As we start doing field theory, we're going to find divergences. So divergences in QFT. These come from high energy. Who knows if they're reliable? I'll write them that they're not. They're not reliable because we don't know what's going on up there. And if we had a finite theory at high energies, they wouldn't exist. But they're there. They're local, but they're boring. They're just part of the technology of doing things. You're then, when you renormalize, you measure. So you do something to determine these parameters. If you have a known high energy theory, that you've studied elsewhere, you can match these parameters. If your theory is unknown, you basically have to measure. So at some stage you have to do something to determine your parameters. So when we're doing gravity, we certainly don't know what the high energy theory is. We're going to have some parameters there. We're just going to go out and we'll measure them in that case. But neither, that's also in some ways a boring step. There's no real predictive power. The predictive power comes in the third step. You basically then have to separate high energy from low energy. Okay, and we're going to do this using the locality. Low energy is non-local, because high energy is local. There has to be some distinguishing feature. Non-locality is a good example. And the predictions live here. Okay, so I'm going to take, yes.
What exactly do you mean when you say the low energy theory is non-local?
Well, so it's non-local in the sense that if you were in coordinate space, you would actually have two different points involved. So like 1 over r. 1 over r is non-local in this sense. It takes the point of one object, the point of the other object, and there's a 1 over r connecting the two of them. So in the gravity case that we'll see, there's corrections that go like 1 over r cubed, 1 over r squared. Those are non-local corrections in position space. We will end up relating those effects to things that have non-analytic behaviors in momentum space. So a very typical example is a logarithm in a scattering amplitude. Can't come from anything local.
So quite locally, you just mean delta function potentials.
Delta functions are the ultimate local stuff, yes.
Yeah.
And delta functions, derivative of delta functions, are all stuff that can be coming from high energies. And so it's you can't differentiate that from low energy effects. But low energy effects are non-local also because particles propagate long distances. If you have a massless photon and you do a loop, it propagates a non-zero distance, whereas the high energy stuff all is local. So the key to differentiating some of the stuff is, in thinking about it, is this locality argument. In practice, this separation you'll often do in scattering amplitudes turns out to be things that are not your local parameters from your Lagrangian, but are something different, and typically are logs. So surprisingly, your logs are some of the most predictive aspects of the calculation. Okay? Yes?
Just on point B, in terms of matching and measuring,
yeah.
So is matching, like, for example, if you have a QED theory, like, you just when you've renormalized, you have a running coupling, so you just measure that particular coupling and measure
right.
Matching, and then
right.
Measuring is, because the same thing would appear as an effective field theory with different operators, so then you have to measure each. Is that what it is?
Yes. Yes, in some sense. So I'm thinking of also of often one takes a theory that you know, like the standard model, and truncates it to an effective field theory at low energies. So the example that might best illustrate that is if you're doing gauge boson exchange in the standard model, the G Fermi is actually a prediction of the theory. So you write out the operator, you know the operator from the symmetries of the theory, and you match that G Fermi onto the predictions of the full standard model. But if I'm working at low energies, I can just go straight from there. So the determination of G Fermi in the standard model is an example of matching. Okay. Okay, so what I'd like to do is I'm going to take you through an extended calculation where we see these different effects come in. And that calculation is the linear sigma model. It's the Higgs sector of the standard model. But it also, it's one of its beauties is that you can construct the effective field theory by hand. The effective field theory looks very different than the linear sigma model, but you can get there from the original starting point without, but strictly by hand. So the linear sigma model. So the Lagrangian has a set of fields in it, as sigma and phi, and maybe I won't, in the interest of time, write out fermions. It's 1/4, 1/2, sorry, of course, d mu sigma squared plus d mu pi vector squared. Then there's the plus mu, it's the Higgs sector, it's plus mu squared over 2, sigma squared plus pi squared, and then lambda over 4, sigma squared plus pi squared, squared. And pi comes in three varieties of this, pi 1, pi 2, pi 3, so it's a vector quantity. And just to show you where we're going, the effective field theory for this, the effective field theory is d squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger, where u is the exponential pi tau dot pi over v. V is the VEV of this theory, the Higgs VEV mu squared over lambda. Okay? So this theory and the effective field theory look amazingly different. Yet at low energies, they're the same theory, and we can, in fact, it's much easier to calculate as a quantum field theory in the effective field theory than it is to do it in the full theory. We'll actually show you the calculations and talk about how painful they are. Okay, the pathway, of course, we know this is a theory that has spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the usual pathway is to take the expectation value of the sigma field is V is the square root of mu squared over lambda. The expectation value of the pion field is 0. And we write sigma is V plus sigma tilde. And I actually want to write this out, not because I'm a masochist, but I want to do a calculation with it. I know, I see that. It's hopefully going to come back in. I will start writing when it comes back in. Okay, there we go. The Lagrangian then has the 1/2 mu sigma squared minus 2 mu squared sigma squared plus 1/2 d mu pi squared. Then there's minus lambda v sigma twiddle sigma squared pi squared. And then minus lambda over 4 sigma squared plus pi squared. Okay, I'm actually use that in a calculation. So the obvious things you point out, the sigma's become massive. It's now my heavy particle that I'm going to remove from the theory. The pions are light. They have m equal to zero. And there's this interaction here is going to be useful in the calculation. There's a trilinear interaction that wasn't there to begin with.
Okay. This might be a really stupid question, but what type of object is d mu of a three vector?
D mu of a, it's an isotopic. It's the vector pi carries like pi plus pi minus pi zero. It's like the three charge states. So
when you take
it, I would take this would be d mu pi 1 squared plus d mu pi 2 squared plus d mu pi 3 squared.
So this whole thing has this little 4 symmetry.
So this says yes. So this, yes, we can do the symmetry here. It's the symmetry of just the part with the vector signs over it, the pions, is an SU2 symmetry. It has the pions are form a triplet. This has a larger symmetry than that. You can rotate between the sigmas and the pis. That's an O4 symmetry. You can see it here. If I have four fields, sigma squared plus pi 1 squared plus pi 2 squared plus pi 3 squared, and it's an invariant of a four-dimensional object. Okay. Any other questions about the basic setup? Okay. The way the pathway is to start by renaming the fields. Okay. So at first I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to do a little notational trick. The notational trick is I'm going to define sigma is capital sigma is little sigma plus I tau dot pi. Okay, and tau is the Pauli matrices. And so this is a matrix B. Sigma is times the unit matrix and tau is the Pauli matrices. So this is now a matrix object. But it can be converted back to the other type of object. I take trace of sigma dagger. Let me put a half in front of that. It's 1/2 trace of sigma squared plus I pi minus I pi because of the dagger plus tau dot pi quantity squared. This is just sigma squared plus pi vector squared. Okay, so the objects that appeared in my other Lagrangian are just sigma and sigma dagger. And without any change at all, I then write the original Lagrangian as 1/4 trace d mu sigma dagger, plus mu squared over 4 trace sigma dagger minus lambda over 16 trace sigma dagger quantity squared. Okay, so there's no change at all in what I've done there. Now, it takes a little bit of work, but there's a symmetry of this theory. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do it in detail much. The symmetry is that if sigma is transformed, so it's a matrix, it's transformed on the left and the right by SU2 matrices.
Sorry.
Yes.
Did you say that tau was the Pauli matrix?
Pauli matrices, yes.
So how do you have a 2x2 matrix done into a 3 vector?
The two by, the everything is 2 by 2 here.
Would pi just, would pi become a 2?
Yeah, okay, so there's three Pauli matrices.
Yes.
So it's tau 1 times pi 1,
okay.
Tau 2 times pi 2, tau 3 times pi 3, okay? Okay, so here, if L and R were the same SU2 matrix, then it wouldn't do anything on the sigma field there at the start because that has multiplied by the unit matrix. So this is just your usual isospin rotations of the pi field. It turns out that's what it corresponds to. However, if L and R are different, then you're mixing the sigmas and the pis, the unit matrix also gets transformed. And so this is actually an expression of the full symmetry of the theory. I'm going to use it later on. Okay, but now, so now I've done just little stupid tricks. I found the ground state. I've renamed the fields. Now here's the transition to the EFT. So now going to EFT, I'm going to do, which is something that's not a stupid trick. I'm going to rename the fields. Okay, so sigma, which was sigma plus I tau dot pi, it's a matrix again that contains these three fields. I'm going to suddenly call this V plus S times U. Okay, now the U is going to, I'm going to call exponential I tau dot pi prime over V. And so pi prime is not exactly the same as pi that I started with. But if I start writing this thing out, it starts looking like what we had before. If I write this out, it's so V plus S is the first term.
Yes. Sorry, is V a number and S a field?
V was that square root of mu squared over lambda. That was the vacuum expectation value that we found before. Okay. And, okay, so it is a number. S is the field. So V plus S is the first term when U is 1. And then if I take the next term, I have tau dot pi over pi prime over V. Over V, but times V. So those guys cancel. Get rid of them. And then there's a lot of cross terms. Now this is a bit funny, but this tells me that in my original theory, I had sigma was V plus sigma twiddle, so that S is equal to sigma twiddle plus other stuff. Pi is equal to pi prime plus other stuff. So I've renamed in such a way that the first terms are the same. Now that's not a trivial matter, but it suddenly makes my Lagrangian look very simple. Okay, so I'll write out what the Lagrangian is. So now there's still no approximation here. I've got L is 1/2 d mu s minus 2 mu squared s, d mu s squared, sorry. And then I have plus V plus S over 4 squared trace d mu u, d mu u dagger. And then the interaction pieces are lambda V S cubed minus lambda over 4 S to the fourth. Okay. So again, at this stage, there's no approximation. I've just renamed. Okay, the symmetry is actually still the same. The symmetry
Do you have like a square in the square bracket?
Yes, thank you. The symmetry is just like before, is now u goes to left, u r dagger. The v plus s just sort of factors out. It's just like it's a scalar field. Okay, but now what's funny here, what's nice, is that the pions live only right here. The polynomial interactions, lambda, the polynomial interactions don't involve the pions at all. Whereas back in the earlier version, the interactions involved them a lot. So let's go back and see it up here. I see it. I'll get it back in. Okay, so our original form here had polynomial interactions for all the fields. The effect of Lagrangian has only derivative interactions. And we've started to make that transition here. The light particles have these derivative interactions. They have these derivative interactions for the light fields and all the polynomial interactions of the heavy fields. Okay, so now I've got a heavy field there. Let's try to write out the effects of that heavy field. Well, the first order, since it's heavy, we know that it doesn't contribute to anything. So the first order, you would just drop it. You would just say the Lagrangian is v squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger. That's the effect of Lagrangian at lowest order. At next order, you would have an effect that looks like you exchanged this S field. Now called S. And just like you do with W exchange, you get an interaction on one side, you get 1 over MW squared, you get the interaction on the other side. We get the same thing here, except that the interaction there has a V plus S trace d mu u dagger. Okay, so if I do the same thing there, I'm going to get something that has 1 over M S squared. What I get is V squared over 8 M S squared trace d mu u dagger. Everything squared. So that's the equivalent of the W interaction. Does everyone see how that appears? It comes from just replacing that propagator by 1 over MS squared. But the second term has four derivatives in it. The first term has 2, so low energy is the effect. All comes from the first interaction. And so there's my effective interaction plus a correction. So there's the effective field theory constructed from a renormalizable field theory to start with. What's interesting is that it's very easy to do calculations that show that these are exactly equivalent. Let me do one for you. The equivalence here comes from the following.
It's
first, it seems very strange that there's going to be an equivalence, because the one had polynomial interactions without derivatives, and the other one had derivatives only. But there's something going on here. Let me calculate pi plus pi zero goes to pi plus pi zero. And I'm not going to get all the Feynman rules for you exactly here, but you can sort of see what it is. Pi plus is 1 over square root of 2, pi 1 plus pi 2. And so you just basically write out the Feynman rules from that. The type of things that you should expect is you get a quartic interaction that this is going to go like lambda, because that was lambda phi to the fourth. There was pi's all over the place. There are 4 pi's there. And then you also get a piece that comes from the exchange. I'm now in the original theory, so this is my sigma twiddle. I'm in my original theory. Sigma twiddle couples up to pi plus and pi zero. Okay. If I write out the answer, minus I m is minus I lambda. The first term is just lambda, the quartic interaction. The second term, well, I gave you the Lagrangian there and pointed out the triple coupling. The triple coupling then is plus minus 2i lambda v squared. So one of those at each vertex. There's a q squared over minus m sigma twiddle squared. And that's vertex here. M sigma twiddle squared is 2 mu squared. So this is, let's just do it, it's minus 2i lambda v, 1 plus 2 lambda v squared over q squared minus 2 mu squared. Remember, you remember v is the square root of mu squared over lambda. So when I have v squared, the lambda and u squared are the same things. The upstairs then is 2 mu squared. The downstairs is q squared minus 2 mu squared. There's a cancellation that goes on here. At q squared goes to 0, this vanishes. So this ends up equaling I. It's q squared over v squared minus q to the fourth over m sigma squared v squared. So there's the calculation. Now, something has happened here that's somewhat remarkable. The polynomial interactions that we had, just like lambda, have canceled, and there's a momentum-dependent interaction that comes out there. That wasn't obvious until you did the calculation. However, if we had enough time here, we could explain that it's a expected consequence of such a theory with spontaneous symmetry breaking. But it happens. I just did it by construction. If I do the same thing with the effect of Lagrangian, in the effect of Lagrangian, there's no particular cancellation going on. We have this guy goes like two derivatives, goes like q squared. And this guy with an s here has two derivatives up at the top, q squared at the bottom, q squared at the top. So all these interactions now are momentum dependent because of that fact that the chiral Lagrangian, the effect of Lagrangian there, has derivatives. And as you're not surprising, you do this plus this, and I get q squared over v squared from the first term, and I get q to the fourth minus second term. And so I get an exact equivalence of the low energy theory, structure of the theory from two exceptionally different Lagrangians. One has a classic form of effective Lagrangian that it only contains the light particles in the theory, and I didn't need to know what exists at high energy. The other one, you have to know that that sigma exists, and it has very, very special couplings that just happen to cancel. So the effective Lagrangian is a more efficient way of proceeding. And it also incorporates these cancellations that have to happen. Because if I gave you a more complicated process, like two particles going to four particles, those cancellations are incredibly painful to find. But the effective Lagrangian, you just write it out. You write the low energy piece out just by expanding the simple Lagrangian. Okay, the part of what we did there, the only non-trivial part of what we did two things that were non-trivial. One was this renaming, and the other was the energy expansion. The energy expansion we've talked about. The renaming is what's called Hogg's theorem. Hogg's theorem, which I'll just basically say that names don't matter, that you can do renaming. Okay, so I can do these renamings. The only thing that I needed was for Hogg's theorem to be true, I needed that the sigma Tweddle field equaled the S field plus higher order corrections, and that the pi field equals pi prime field plus higher order corrections. So I need that they start out with the same coefficient to begin with. Now, so basically, you basically need, you know, psi is equal to some function of phi with f of phi equaling phi plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so you have to start off linear. Okay, and so it's a mathematical theorem, but just think of it like an experimenter. If I satisfy this condition that they start off linear here and everything else then goes into interactions, then like an experimenter, when I'm far away and I prepare my initial state, I don't know whether the theorist is using his S fields or his sigma Tweddle fields, because I'm just doing the free part of the theory. I just know that I have a particle of certain mass and I'm going to send it into an interaction. I then do the experiment, I measure it later on. I again don't know whether the theorist decided to use one set of names or another set of names in doing the calculation. So I had better get the same answer for physical calculations independent of that. And Hogg tells us that we do. And we just calculate. So if you're adventurous and want to do a problem, I have a problem. The first problem on the exercises page is to do this for a theory that looks like U1, where you will see the beauty of it immediately. When you do the calculation in the original basis, you're going to work for, I don't know, a half hour to make the cancellation work. And you do it in the effective field theory basis, which is quickly constructed, it'll take you a half a minute to calculate the amplitude. Okay? So if you want to do that. Okay, so this is the construction of the effective Lagrangian. But now, I want to go on to loop effects. So at this stage, I have two theories. One's valid at all energies, and one's valid at low energies, the effect of Lagrangian. So we have the linear sigma model is a renormalizable theory. The effective Lagrangian The effect of Lagrangian fits into a category that's called non-renormalizable. Okay, because it has all powers of the fields there. It's not just stopping at some power of the fields like renormalizable theories do. So how can you proceed? Well, you're going to proceed by taking this Lagrangian. You take the lowest order. You put it in loops. You do loops. You see the results. There's going to be divergences. The divergences will be local. They will look like a local Lagrangian. And so we will need local Lagrangians that satisfy the symmetry of the theory. You then will renormalize. Your local theory, and then you'll see what's left. You'll match or measure. In this case, we'll match. And then we'll end up with predictions. So here's the power of effective field theory. Lecture's over.
That happened to Maxine once. I think that there's some magic button that gets pushed on the tablet that.
It's on my tablet.
What's that?
It's on my tablet.
I think I'm going to know that the gods on higher probably.
Yes. I mean, I can do blackboard except I have two big formulas coming up. Yes. Okay. I will then seed my talk here.
We can follow it on that.
Yeah, we can just turn around.
Oh, I picked that for you.
That doesn't work.
All right. Let me actually then just transition to the blackboard for a moment.
Our gods have abandoned us.
I bet he can't transfer $1 million on my.
Fast check.
It's warming up and it'll be warm.
Yeah. So
they really have no buttons in the room for moving the screen up and
down. Yeah, there is, but normally it's you turn the whole thing on and it. What happens is that once it turns itself off, it pauses so that it cools down the projector, so you always have the light again for that.
Yeah.
All right, you're back.
All right, good. So it actually allowed me to sneak in some formulas that I'd seeded down further. So the calculation in the original is actually exceptionally painful. It involves bunch of diagrams, the worst of which is diagrams that look like this, where you take pi, so I'm doing the same calculation, pi plus pi zero, pi plus pi zero, and you have S and S. Okay, so there's a box diagram there that occurs. The if you've ever done a box diagram calculation, you will know that the box diagram is a bear. You know, the formulas for it take several pages, and it just takes a long time to even just figure out what the notation means. So that diagram by itself is a calculation that will take you quite a long time if you were to start from scratch. There's diagrams that look like this, which are triangle diagrams. So this is an S here, these are pi's here. That's not so bad, that's doable. There are diagrams that look like bubble diagrams. Pi, and also SS. Those guys are not so bad, and et cetera. There's a bunch of diagrams. You cross these in all possible ways, and it's a long, long calculation that's a terrible bear. The low energy limit, however, isn't so bad. So if I do the whole calculation now, it's not so bad. The low energy limit is shown here in there. Okay. And so it's not so bad. It has a bunch of terms. It has these things that depend on the mass of the heavy field. It has some terms that independent of the mass of the heavy field. It has logarithms. In a you know, very detailed way. Okay, let's do the effective theory. The effective field theory actually isn't so bad to do. In fact, you only need one type of diagram. You need I plus I zero. You need one bubble diagram, and actually you need a cross-channel version of it too. The cross-channel version being where the bubble runs vertically. But that's a simple calculation. And if you end up doing it, you get oh, let's see, I missed one step in the board confusion. I was about to write out the effect of Lagrangian at next order. So what we've already seen is we have the effect of Lagrangian as this v squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger. We saw a term that was trace d mu u dagger quantity squared. Now, in general, we know what its coefficient was at tree level when we exchanged the sigma, but in general, it could have a different coefficient because we're now working at loop level. So let's call its coefficient L1. This is a traditional in the field. L1 is a constant. And in fact, I can write out one more. There's also a second one that I could write out, which is trace d mu u d nu u dagger times itself trace d mu u d nu u dagger. Squeeze it. And I give it a coefficient L2. So basically, the difference here is that the indices mu and nu are different with inside the trace. Okay, when I do this calculation, I get something that looks very similar. I have the first term. It's up there. Well, let me just write something first. The when I did the calculation, bubble diagrams are divergent. This is has a divergence in it. I have absorbed the divergences into renormalized values of these coefficients. So L1 and L2 live here in this formula right there and there. I put an R on them, and L1R is the following, is the bare L1 plus 1 over 384 I squared, 1 over epsilon, and then the log 4 pi for the usual stuff, L2. So this is just MS bar renormalized. L2 is 1 over 192 pi squared times the same thing. So I have done a renormalization to write this form. But the interesting feature is that it has all the same sort of structures in it. It looks almost identical to the one that we had above. And above, we had very specific numbers here. But we had the same logs, and we had the same powers of momentum. Does everyone know ST and U? So I've written this in terms of the Mandelstam variables. S is the S channel energy squared. T is the four momentum transfer squared. And this one has exactly the same forms, except it's got the L1s and L2s floating around there. You can, at this stage, identify or match. You do match. If I identify this, I get exactly the same results at this order. So I've reproduced the full theory by matching these renormalized coefficients to what they are. Now, if I didn't know what the full theory was, I would go out and measure. In any case, we have methods for determining these coefficients. Yet now we have predictions. So the effective field theory, if I went out and I didn't know the effect of the full theory, is determined by two parameters, but it has a very specific momentum dependence. Here, there's no parameters here in these logs. We have a predictive quantum theory, even though we have started with this effective field theory. So the predictions here are things like the structure of the momentum dependence and the structure of the logs. In response to the earlier question that we about non-local, these logs can't be obtained from any local Lagrangian. If you had any Lagrangian written in a derivative expansion, you would never get a logarithm because that can't be expanded in derivatives. Okay, so that's something that's not from a local Lagrangian and is a unique prediction. So we have made this a predictive theory. We can also see from it one of the important features of this effective field theory, and it's also a feature of general relativity, is we have an energy expansion within the loop expansion. That's related to the loop expansion. So remember, we had the energy expansion was this. This was q squared over v squared in my original tree-level calculation. This was q to the fourth over v to the fourth in my original calculation. And so we had an energy expansion in the original calculation. But we also see it in the loop effects. The loop effects all enter t squared, s squared, s. All the loops are a higher order in this, the energy expansion. So we have a, comes out of here as a power counting theorem also. The power counting theorem told us that the lowest order effect of Lagrangian was q squared over v squared. The loop effects, so this is in power counting is called order energy squared, some power of the energy. Loops by construction turned out to be of order energy to the fourth. Okay. And you can sort of see that that's going to happen by dimensional grounds. So let me just do the dimensional analysis for you. I've got a loop like that. My original one had powers of the momentum divided by v squared. So each of these are of order q squared over v squared, and that's q squared over v squared. So this matrix element is 1 over v to the fourth, because I've got two of those, v to the fourth, sorry. That four is crucial, so let me write it neatly. There we go. 1 over v to the fourth times some loop integral that's a function of the external momentum. It, I mean, there's a loop integral inside that's the internal loop momentum. But in the end, once I do the loop, it has to be expressed in terms of the external guys. The amplitude, as you've seen, is dimensionless q squared over v squared is a dimensionless number. V, oh, I, this may be not obvious to everybody. V squared is mu squared over lambda. Mu is the mass of the particle. Lambda is dimensionless. So this goes like mass squared. Okay, so in doing dimensional analysis, that's something that you may not have picked up on immediately. Q squared over v squared, that's dimensionless. This another one has to come out dimensionless also. So if you do dimensional regularization, there's no other momentum around except for the external guys. So this is p external to the fourth over v to the fourth. V to the fourth.
What is the contribution from the second vertex?
So there's a q squared over v squared here, a q squared over v squared there. And these q's really are loop momentum or external momentum. There's some momentum. The thing I'm after is that it goes like 1 over v squared, okay, times momentum. And so if I'm actually calculating this, sometimes the q is changed by the loop momentum also. But in the end, it doesn't matter. The loop momentum gets integrated over, and only external momentum gives the final answer. And so we see then from both direct calculation and from power counting that the loops are of higher order in this. And this is a theorem also. This is the Weinberg theorem. Weinberg theorem says that we have effective Lagrangians that can be written in powers. In this case, it's two powers of the energy, or four powers of the energy, or six powers of the energy, plus that. So the energy expansion goes on there. At order e squared, you need tree level only. At order e to the fourth, you need fourth order, of course, because it's order energy to the fourth to begin with, and you need one loop. With L two vertices. Okay, and then to do order energy this six, you need to go to two loops. Plus, and then you need more and more ingredients as you go up. But this power counting tells us that if we're working to, you know, first and second orders, we actually have not too much to do. Let's work to these orders, which I'll do for general relativity also. This holds also in general relativity, pure general relativity. I'll just need the lowest order Einstein action, get the first piece. The one loop corrections come at the next order. They come a correction. And they worked essentially the same way that I just did for this theory. Okay, so let me take questions then about this, the effective field theory treatment. This is basically the effective field theory treatment that I'm going to take and apply to general relativity. Given the moment, there's no point in starting general relativity right now. So let me break here if that's okay with you. But I'm going to come back and let me explain what I plan to do. I plan to start the construction of general relativity like a particle theorist would, from symmetries and covariant derivatives. And then, so obtain general relativity, the usual one. We will then write out effective Lagrangians for general relativity that have the first term being the Einstein term, the second term being corrections, which we will describe for you. We will show you that the usual Einstein gravity comes out of using the tree level one, and we will get quantum corrections from using the next order ones. So we're going to repeat this not with the linear sigma model, but by doing general relativity. Along the way, I tend to take a moment to break and do the background field method, so that instead of doing Feynman diagrams to renormalize the theory, I can renormalize both this theory and general relativity in a more beautiful way that allows you to see that the symmetries of the theory are unchanged. And so I'll at some stage break, come back to this linear sigma model, show you how in principle renormalize. I won't do the details. And then we'll have built up the tool base at that stage to renormalize general relativity in the same way. Okay, so let's take questions about what we just did.
About the E6,
yes.
Is it two loops from L2 and one loop from L4?
Yes, so the full statement is that it's two loops using L2 vertices, one loop using an L4 vertex and an L2 vertex, and tree level using L6. Okay? And then that generalizes as you go up. Okay? Yes?
Why does renaming only not matter up to linear and in the renamed fields?
Well, so the linear fields is designed to make the free fields identical. So by renaming such that the linear terms match, it tells me that the free field theory with no interactions is the same free field theory, so that I have a particle of one of mass m sigma here and a particle of mass zero to start with. So I know my asymptotic states. And that's the condition of the theorem. It's just a renaming. And it's a renaming then of the interaction parts of the theory, not the free field.
You say renaming doesn't matter. That's enough.
That's enough.
You don't need to add anything else.
Well, if you look at what Hogg says, there is this condition that the free fields have carried the same behavior, because he's discussing scattering amplitudes.
But that's
okay.
The consequence.
That's what he
said. The theory, and you identify what are the scattering states.
You identify the states as you by your free field. That's what he says.
Then you normalize them back by convention.
And so we, I mean, it's what Neil is saying is that we actually have often take greater freedom than this because we don't always, when we're writing down a theory, know what names we should be using. And so being a theorist, you have a lot of freedom to just choose what names you choose to use. The equivalence of the scattering amplitudes, though, is it's a special consequence that's proven rigorously in these mathematical theories.
There is an important caveat, though, right, about non-locality, right? If you say you don't want to put poles into the redefinition because you're going to use you're going to look for the residues of the correlation function to get the S matrix, and if you stick in poles with the redefinition, that's a dangerous thing.
Yeah, I think that's part of what's in that the first term being identical. Okay, if you didn't have that, your first terms wouldn't be identical. Yes?
How many of these loop effects would you get if you simplified your model to, instead of three space and one time dimension, you made zero space? So then the quantum field theory just becomes quantum mechanics. And it'd be the four fields would give quantum mechanics and a four spatial dimensional thing with this four dimensional spherical symmetry thing. I don't know, would there still be loop effects in that quantum mechanical model or the equivalent of loop effects?
There's the equivalent of loop effects.
Right.
So in quantum mechanics, there's, you know, these when you do perturbation theory, you get some over intermediate states.
Right.
That's the equivalent.
If this potential were very tight, the math were big, it'd be like a four, like a three sphere in four space where the four spaces are now just the four fields, and then you'd have quantum mechanics of this thing running around, but because it's a curved space,
I presume, but I don't know that I'm answering your question particularly efficiently, but I assume you're right.
Yeah.
Anybody else before we break? Okay, then let's reconvene tomorrow, and I'll be doing real gravity tomorrow.